Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Hidden Disabilities series on Braincast. In this new series, we aim to talk to people with hidden disabilities, discussing their experiences with the healthcare system and the education system, and what they think is needed from society to support them. My name is Emily, and we are joined by co-host Ray and guest Amelia to discuss idiopathic intracranial hypertension. So, welcome, Amelia. It's very nice to have you on here. How are you, first of all?
Yeah, so I'm good, thank you. So yesterday we went up to Horncastle. So I live down south, but we're moving up north to move house. I currently live in a flat, which is very inaccessible for me. So we need to live in a house, which is obviously going to be a lot more accessible for me because it's bigger. I can get around it. It's open planned and everything. So yesterday we basically went up north to go check that out because it's a new build, so they're still building it obviously. But the days before that, like a couple of days ago, I can't remember now, like, you know, I was not the best. I had a very bad day with my fatigue and everything, so I'm very up and down really.
Yeah, well, how did you manage to do, did you drive in one day to go up to, is it Horncastle?
Yeah.
That sounds like a really long day.
It was long. I don't drive myself. I'm not allowed to. But yeah, it was very tiring. Luckily, I find it so easy to sleep in the car. So that's what I did.
Me too. I went to Wales the other day and I slept the entire time.
Yeah, so many people can't sleep in the car, but I find it so easy. I sleep so much in the car.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about the movement. I couldn't as a child. I was awake all the time in the car, but as I've gotten older, I'm just like, if as soon as I'm in the car, I'm like, I'm asleep.
Literally, me too.
Ray, do you sleep in cars or are you just wide awake?
I do sleep in the cars. It kind of depends. Sometimes I do sleep in the cars. Sometimes I'm just like staring into the oblivion. but yeah, I do find it easy to sleep in the car. I just find it hard to sleep, to be honest, so I can, like, sleep or not sleep anywhere. It doesn't really matter about the... It's not really about the place.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I find something I do, or I definitely used to do when I was younger, is, like, stare out when it's raining and it's, like, the rain is dripping down.
Oh, my God, that's so nostalgic.
And I'm, like, yeah, pretending to be in a music video or something.
So literally. It would always be, like, Leona Lewis, like, Beyonce, yeah. Or, like, Jay-Z or like someone like that.
It's like main character energy, but I was not the main character.
But we all thought we were though.
I was like 12 years old. My emo self is just staring and being like, oh my god, this is just so aesthetic. I'm like, looking back, I'm like, you were 12.
It's like that is so cringe now. Like, like I would never be caught doing that anymore. Yeah.
No.
Anyways, so tell us a bit about yourself, about, you know, your uni course, your hobbies, anything like that, really.
Yeah, so I'm 20 years old and I'm at the Open Uni and I study primary education, but I do want to eventually become an educational psychologist, and my primary education degree should open up the doors for me to be able to become an educational psychologist. So before I fell ill again, I was actually very active. I went to the gym a lot. I've been a swimmer since I was very young, and I was actually training to be a lifeguard at one point, which I loved doing. But now that I can't be active anymore because of my health, I do a lot more things that are a lot more relaxed and you can sit down with. So I love baking. I really like doing crafts. I'm playing Animal Crossing at the moment. I read a lot. And yeah, basically like creative things that you can do sat down.
Yeah, I found those have been really helpful. I started crocheting for that exact reason because I was like, it's something I can just do and not have to expel a lot of energy doing. But Animal Crossing was my lockdown thing. I think I spent like 600 hours on it.
Yeah, it was mine as well. Like literally, I look through my Snapchat memories and it's full of Animal Crossing.
Yeah, literally.
I remember saving up the money to buy a Switch in the game. That was like, it took me ages to save up for, but I was so happy. But then Everyone was buying a Switch in Animal Crossing, so to get it in stock took forever.
I kind of want to ask How did you
for
sort of decide on becoming an educational psychologist? Like, how did you think that you'd go down that path?
Also, can you define, like, say a bit about what an educational psychologist is, just in case?
So an educational psychologist is basically a doctor who, well, doctor psychologist who works with young children. And so for me personally, I had an educational psychologist, and she would really help me in school, both socially and academically. So she would like assess me, she'd like assess like she'd give me like memory tests, and what else, and like maths tests, like English tests, like just like a whole range of educational tests, and just to see how I was doing. And then she would also like have a chat with me and like ask me how I'm doing in school, like how am I with like my friends and stuff, like am I coping well in school, like do I feel anxious being at school, all of that. So that's basically what I want to do, like just help children feel more comfortable in school. And she also really helped me like cope with like exams and stuff, but unfortunately is a child psychologist, so like she's not been my psychologist for years now, so I didn't really have her in like the higher years of secondary school. I mainly remember only seeing her in primary school.
And do you think that really contributed to like who you are as a person now and how you go about with stress and coping with things?
Yeah, I do. But I also get a lot of help from my mum as well. Like my mum, she really helps me like structure my day. Like I need my thing, like I need my day, like I need a lot of structure. I need things like planned out, but then I struggle to do that myself. Like I need step A, step B, step C, but like in my head it's all like jumbled up. So like I need the help like to get it like sorted, you know, like
Yeah. Do you think that's like related to the illness and your health, or is that something that's always been the case?
yeah. So we don't know whether it's like the case of like the effects of brain surgery or the illness itself. I think it's probably got a lot to do with the effect of like the amount of brain surgeries I've had, that it's probably left me with quite a lot of like learning difficulties.
Yeah, how many brain surgeries have you had then?
A lot, over 30.
Oh wow, that is a lot. And
Yeah,
what's
so I think it's
how?
had a big impact, like the brain surgery plus the time I've had off school, like just the brain surgery and the time I've had off school and the illness together, all of that combined.
Yeah, that's quite a lot to for a young person to go through. I mean, me and Ray study neuroscience and we know like the effects that these things can have developmentally. Yeah. So what are the ages that you started like your first surgery to, I guess it was must have been recently if there's 30.
So my surgery started, I'd say, about 5 or 4. And then
Right.
my most recent one was last year when I was 19.
Okay, so talking about that, if you just explain a bit about idiopathic intracranial hypertension.
So IRH is a brain illness that causes high pressure around the brain, and then it puts pressure on the optic nerve, which can then lead to blindness.
Okay. So when it's slightly different from the next question, but like when about did you sort of like find out about the fact that you have IIH, or like when did you exactly sort of like start seeing the symptoms that would like sort of lead you to get the diagnosis for IIH?
Yeah, my mum pretty much saw it from birth, but I wasn't diagnosed until I was 4.
Okay. So is a saying that it might be like a genetic thing then, or it was something to do with trauma at birth or something?
No, there's actually, they actually can't think of a reason why I have it. It is like more common in females, but that's females who are like of a childbearing age, and obviously I was born with it. So although I'm female, the doctors have not got a clue why I've got it. I've actually still got a low risk of having it. So yeah, they
Oh,
have
that's
no idea why I have
interesting.
it.
Yeah, that's really interesting that they've got, well, I mean, it's doctors often don't have an idea about why people might have things, but it's interesting that you're very different from the stereotypical person who would have
The prime, like, most doctors, like, think, like, it's like most commonly seen in, like, females who are overweight and of childbearing, but it's important that people realize that not everyone with IOH is overweight. That's just like, it's most highly seen in the statistics.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's one of the questions that I also wanted to ask, because I was looking, like, while making the questions, I was looking through, like, the NHS website, and one of the suggested treatments for IOH was just given as, like, weight loss.
And
that kind of, like, took me off guard. I'm like, how would that really, like...
That is very misleading. Yeah, there are people with IOH that are overweight, but it's not the primary cause.
Yeah, because I was trying to look into the causes of the condition, and no one really had, like, a proper idea as to, like any literature can, I can find a literature sort of, like, guiding towards proper causes. Yeah. One of the other questions that I had was, you mentioned you are sort of in the process of getting, like, an early diagnosis for orthostatic hypertension.
Yeah.
So, like, is it related to IOH, or is it, like, separate diagnosis altogether?
It's separate altogether.
So can you describe what orthostatic hypertension is?
Yeah, so basically, it originally started where I would, like, get really tachycardic, like, just within, like, 2 minutes of standing, I could barely clean my teeth without, like, feeling really dizzy. I would walk really short distances and become really, like, out of breath. And then it eventually progressed to the point where I was fainting every single time I stood up. So then finally saw a cardiologist, and they diagnosed me with orthostatic hypertension. And they basically said that the reason I'm fainting every time I stand up is because my blood pressure is dropping dramatically low, which is actually quite, like, funny, because, like, when I was in the hospital, my blood pressure, it was constantly too low, and, like, they would always say to me, drink more, your blood pressure's too low, and I'd be like, I've drunk loads today, but all they did was have a go at me for having low blood pressure. I was like, I literally can't help it, my blood pressure's low.
Yeah, it's like, why have a go? Like, having a go isn't actually going to do anything about the problem. It's just going to make someone feel worse.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, obviously, orthostatic hypertension is separate from POTS. Are you aware of the differences? And could you just explain what the differences might be?
I'm not entirely sure of the differences, to be honest.
Okay. I mean, the thing I know is just... orthostatic hypertension is that, and POTS stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. So if you're not aware of the differences, that's fine. It's just very weird that there's two things that seem very similar to me. But
it is, because I thought it was POTS first of all, but, like, because also when I, like, got diagnosed with it, so I saw the nurse, assuming she's the specialist nurse, she at first said, I think this could be POTS, and then she said, I'm just going to pop outside and speak to the consultant. And then she came back, and then she was like, he doesn't think it's POTS, but he thinks it's orthostatic hypertension. So, yeah, I was like, I thought it was POTS as well, because, like, I actually don't understand the differences, if I'm being honest with you. Like, I get short of breath, tachycardia, fainting. I honestly do not know the differences, but the medication they put me on to treat me with is working.
That's good. It's good that it's working. I mean, I do know that POTS is to do with, I think you have to have a 10 heartbeat increase when you stand up, or there's an increase that you have to have in heart rate. But if you're saying you were tachycardic, that's just made me think. I'm like, huh, what is the difference?
I still don't know what the difference is. Like, the nurse did tell me, but that was back in April, so I completely forgot.
No, that's fair. And for orthostatic hypertension, what was, like, the, did you have to have, like, a tilt table test, or was it just based on doing a blood pressure thing?
Yeah, so I had a ECG, a 48-hour one, that showed a lot of tachycardia. And then I also documented on the sheet of like symptoms list that they gave me, I documented a lot of episodes of feeling shortness of breath, and then basically I told her about my symptoms, and they did the blood pressure test, and they said that it sounds like orthostatic hypertension.
Okay, yeah. Ray, you wanna?
My next question was not related to orthostatic hypertension, but you were mentioning about like diagnostic tests, and I know like you sort of got diagnosed with IIH when you were 4, but were there sort of any like standard like diagnostic procedures that you had to go through that you could probably go over with us if that's possible?
Yeah. So, wait, sorry, one second. Did you want me to go over the symptoms, like, leading to my diagnosis for IIH?
Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I had headaches. I was really tired all of the time. I had a very big lack of coordination and balance. Brain fog, so very forgetful. I can't understand simple things. Unable to do simple tasks, like, still to this day I struggle to tie my shoelaces. So I was actually very old when I learned how to tie my shoelaces, and I struggle with cutting up my food, light sensitivity, and trouble socializing was a big thing, because I was either too tired to socialize or my head hurt too much to socialize, which honestly like really affected me, because other children didn't understand. They just thought I was that child that didn't want to play with anyone else, when really I didn't feel well enough to play with anyone else.
That's really interesting. Considering those were like the symptoms at the time, did your school or doctors think it was, what was the first conclusion they came to about what could be going on?
Yeah, so my diagnosis to get IIH was really difficult to get. I went to A&E so many times, every single time, because I'd literally just started school. My mum was told she's got this childhood illness, she's got that childhood illness. It was, everything was put down to a virus, which is actually funny, because even though I've like had this illness my whole life, I've actually never caught like a cold, the flu, like all of that stuff. I've actually been really lucky with that. So yeah, I've never caught all of that. Anyway, so one time that we went to A&E, we saw another A&E doctor, and he like noticed that I'd been to A&E a lot in such a short space of time. So he said that this really needs to be investigated properly. So he did some tests. So he did some eye tests, which showed papedema. And then I had some scans, which showed that I have small ventricles in my brain. So I was then referred to a specialist hospital, John Radcliffe, and then it was confirmed that I have idiopathic intracranial hypertension.
And can you explain what papedema is for everybody?
Yeah, so papedema is basically swelling of the optic nerve, which puts you at a very high risk of blindness.
Right, okay. Okay. Ray, did you have anything else to question?
So you mentioned like you went to the A&E a lot of times, and like obviously like the doctors kept on like diagnosing you with like different kinds of childhood disorders and stuff like that. So my question was slightly related to that, in terms of like how exactly was like the process of getting the diagnosis, in terms of, because a lot of doctors they continuously sort of like mentioned like you have this, you have that, but then no one really like went like, wait, why are you coming here so many times, you shouldn't be. So it took like a lot of different visits to finally like for them to go like, wait, we need to look into this. So
yeah, it took so many visits, like it was, everything was put down to childhood illness. If my mum didn't meet that one doctor, I don't know where we'd be today. It was really lucky that that one doctor was in that day.
I think that's a really common thing, because I remember I went to A&E. I was a lot older. I was like 16, 17 when everything started happening with me. But the amount of times I'd go to A&E and I'd be sent away, like they'd be like, no, it's nothing, you're just making it up, or there's nothing going on, or you're just, and then list anxiety or something along those lines.
Exactly.
And then there was one doctor, and one doctor alone who went, oh no, there's something going on here, and started referring me to things. And that's a really common thing. And I guess that's something that a lot of people, even if you don't have a chronic illness, it, like, just a lot of people can relate to with just doctors.
Thing is, I feel like if they listened to you like straight away and like did the test straight away, it would like really help like the waiting times. Like, even if it turns out you have nothing, like them not investigating it just builds up the waiting list, because you'll be coming to A&E like more and more, like the longer
that's true,
like teach you about like any help.
That's true, because the wait times in the NHS are so incredibly long. It's like you could be waiting for 8, 9, 10 hours, like even longer than that. And people, some people don't get chairs, there's no beds, people are lying in the corridors, things like that. And if you just deal with the person, I get that the NHS, there's a lot of stuff going on and funding is an issue and staff is an issue. But I feel like if you listen to the people the first time, because most people won't go to A&E just for the attention, I've found.
Like, I like going to A&E, like, is literally like hell in there, isn't it? Like the bright lights, the noise, like, is awful. Yeah. Like when I'm in A&E, like I go there at my worst, obviously, but like when I'm in A&E, I like, I can't cope with the lights, and like there's nothing you can do about the lights and like the noise. Like I remember I was in the waiting room of A&E, like I think it was like a couple years ago, and like I remember the telly was on. I was literally like, can we turn the telly down? But obviously that was out of my hands, the telly had to be on, and I was like, I just bit the noise, like I've got the noise of people chatting, but I had to have the noise of the telly. That literally like tipped me over the edge.
Talking about A&E, actually, I don't know if you have had experience with both pediatrics and adult, but have you had experience with both, and if so, like what have been the differences you've noticed in A&E specifically?
So with children's, I can't remember too much about children's. So obviously before I was diagnosed, we went to A&E, but I think when I was diagnosed, I think I had direct ward access. So I don't remember too much about A&E in my childhood. Like, I think I went, but I really don't remember that much about
it. Yeah, that's fair.
But in my adulthood, now I don't have direct ward access. Going to A&E is awful because I'm not a textbook patient, and like it's, you know, it's a lot of waiting around, and like for some reason, like at my local A&E, which is Reading, they don't have a neuro department, which makes things even more difficult for me because they obviously have to liaise with my consultants at the John Radcliffe, but obviously my consultants, they're surgeons, so there's a big wait time because obviously that operating, and like they really lack the knowledge, like not having like any neuro specialist at Reading. And like I remember last year I went, I actually think it was like a rheumatologist or something like that that I saw, so obviously someone who doesn't know anything about IIH, like it just, it doesn't help when they don't know anything about your illness.
Yeah, you have to be the one to explain things, and you're like, I am not in a place right now, especially A&E, you're like, I'm not in a place to explain everything to you for you to then come back and tell me you can't help me.
Exactly. Like, I remember, so I had this, like, I had the trouble at A&E, and then I was admitted for a short time at Reading last year. And, like, I told the consultant who was, like, in charge of the ward that month, must have been like a general surgeon or something, and like I said about like my difficulties and all of that, and like his response was basically like, we can't put like a flag like on the computer to tell everyone like about your difficulties and stuff. Like, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he basically like dismissed it, and he was like, I can't, you know, tell everyone about your difficulties, and like
I find A&E is, I understand that there's so many issues with the NHS and with funding and things, and that the doctors and nurses and all the healthcare professionals, they try their best, and they can be really great in some cases. But I have a feeling with more complex cases, more long term, they really struggle because they don't have the resources to help at the time.
That is so true. Like, there has been some times where, like, I've gone to A&E and I've been like, I've actually like had a visit today and I felt listened to, and like those visits are like amazing because like you're in and you're out and like you're fixed, like not fixed, but like you can see the progress, you know.
Yeah, I remember going to A&E once. It was before my health started getting bad, and I went to A&E because I broke my finger during a netball match. And like
Yeah.
thinking back on it, I'm like, wow, they were really good in that scenario. But that's because there's an easy fix. There's something they can do.
And they could probably see that your finger was broken. It was probably like right in their face.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, I feel like one of the main things is like most of the staff you mentioned, like they don't have the resources, they're overworked, they're understaffed. They don't really like at that point, they don't really have the capacity. They're like, no, I can't think about this now. So they just dismiss any sort of like valid concerns that the patient might have, which is like not really useful. It's not good for the patient. It's not good for any sort of future diagnosis that they might receive. It just sort of like keeps everything in the dark, like in terms of like what's going on, and it's not really helpful for anyone.
And
Definitely.
also the whole thing with Reading not having a neuro department, like what's that about?
I actually don't know, but it's actually so annoying because obviously it's my local. So like I don't really like stay, like I've literally stayed at Reading like what, like for two or three admissions. So I don't stay at Reading because I mean, like they don't have the capacity to help me with not having a neuro department, but it's difficult then not having a neuro department.
And you know, so you're moving house and you're moving up north. Was one of the considerations when deciding where to move somewhere that has like a neuro department or departments that can help close by, or was that not something that was really considered?
No, not really, because I'm currently under London and the John Radcliffe, so I'll still be traveling to them for like my main appointments, and then I'll just go to whatever my new local hospital will be. I've got no idea if I have a neuro department or not.
Yeah, that's fair enough. So London and Oxford is where you're. How do you find London and Oxford? Because they've got a lot of big links and networks that help with there.
Yeah, so I've been under Oxford since I was four. And then I was referred to London literally of this year. So I've only had one in-person appointment. I've had like one appointment with them and then a set of scans. So I'm very new to them. But so far they've been really good.
Okay, yeah.
As for the links, I don't know much about the links.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because I'm in John Radcliffe for neuropsychology,
Yeah.
and I remember when I was originally getting, well, went to I wasn't even getting a diagnosis, I just went to the hospital one day, and they were telling me that the doctor who works in the neuro department at my local hospital also worked in Oxford. So I was like, oh, that's nice that there's links to other places.
Yeah, the only thing I do know is that my consultant at the John Radcliffe, he was taught by my consultant at London. That's the only link I know, which
Was
I thought was crazy.
that like a coincidence, or was that something that they referred like?
Yeah, so my consultant at the John Radcliffe, he doesn't know, my adult consultant, sorry, he doesn't know what's going on, which is why he referred me to London. And like he obviously said, this guy was my teacher, so I know he's good, so I'm going to refer to you. He's got a bit more of an interest in IIH than me, so he's a bit more like specialized with it, you know.
Yeah, that's good. That's good that I like when doctors admit where their limits are instead of just trying to make you feel like
Yeah.
you're in the wrong or something. It's like I do know my life, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it did take a long time for my consultant to admit it. Like he mentioned about this London consultant like a year ago, and like he kept on refusing to refer me. He kept on going, oh, I can't refer you because I'll look stupid in front of him. He was my teacher, so, and like every single time, like he like kept on refusing to refer me. So when he finally referred me, honestly, I was so glad.
Yeah. It's
Because
kind of weird that they think take it on their ego and be like,
it's
oh,
a genuinely
I
thing.
can't refer this patient to this person because I look stupid. And it's literally like about this patient and their health. It's not about your
Exactly,
ego,
it's
so
nothing to do with you. Like, it's better for the patient if you refer them to someone who you feel may know better than you, because like I do know that my consultant's ego at John Radcliffe was very hurt by not knowing what's going on with me. So
yeah.
I am glad that he eventually referred me to London.
Yeah, and you said you've had one appointment there, so how are you finding the new consultant?
Yeah, so I felt that he listened to me like a lot at the appointment. I can't say any more than that because I literally have only seen him for like what, 5, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But at the appointment, he did seem like really nice and he listened to me. And I actually did quite like that. So when I was in the waiting room, he was a little bit late to the appointment. So when he did eventually call me, he was just like, "Oh, sorry, I'm late. I was just reading up on your notes." And I did appreciate that he did like take the time to like educate himself about me instead of like going into the appointment like and rushing it. Like, I would rather them
Yeah.
be late for that than like not listen to me.
Yeah, well, I've had appointments in the past where it's for like a second opinion or something, and I've gone in and they've gone, so tell me why you're here, what's going on? And I'm like, I get they have to ask those questions, but it was obvious that they've known nothing about me, and I'm like, okay, well now I have to go and explain, which is going to take half an hour to explain like everything that's going on. Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, like the London consultant, obviously he asked me that as well, like, why are you here? But he
Yeah.
also said that he looked at my notes. It was like a bit of both. He was like, "I see in your notes," and like I said, I would say stuff, and then he would say, "Oh yes, I read that in your notes."
Yeah.
So, you
That's
know.
really, he sounds like he's at least taking it seriously, which is not
Yeah.
something everyone with a chronic illness can say about their doctors.
No. Yeah, I've got an
Yeah.
appointment with him in September, so hopefully he's got some plans.
Yeah, that's good. You kind of did answer it, but did you have any potential risk of contributed towards a condition? But you also mentioned like they don't really know, like the doctors when you got diagnosed, they don't really know as to like why you would have IAH at like such a young age, especially since like it's not sort of like the prime group. You mentioned like IAH is mainly like in like older women of childbearing age, and you obviously got diagnosed in your childhood, so it's that was basically the question. But from what you've experienced, do you think there might be sort of like genetic factors or just like hereditary factors involved in it?
No, I think my parents got like genetic testing, and I think it all came back to say that it's not genetic at all. The only thing that may put me at risk, though, is the fact that my ventricles in my brain are pretty much non-existent. So that's the only reason that the doctors can think that I could have IAH,
Yeah.
but ultimately they don't actually know why I have IAH.
And just for anyone who's listening, talking about ventricles in the brain, that's where cerebrospinal fluid kind of gets produced and how it flows around. But yeah, okay. So I guess the next question was, you've already spoken a bit about seeking the diagnosis. And I'm assuming it was through the NHS, but did you have any do you have to go through private at all for anything?
No, it was all through the NHS, my diagnosis was.
Okay, yeah. And how did you find the NHS overall kind of dealt with it?
Not in the best way. I've faced a lot of skepticism from like medical professionals. So because it's like such a rare illness, not a lot of doctors understand it, and I feel like doctors have a very black and white view of the illness. So if you're not a textbook patient, they really struggle. And I've really noticed this while I've been in adults.
So is the textbook patient what you described, a woman of childbearing age who might be overweight, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the symptoms, are those Are there any symptoms that you've had that might not be that common and are rare, or are the symptoms very much the same in each person?
A lot of people IOH get vomiting, which luckily I don't. I think with me, it's the fact that, like, I don't look ill. Like,
yeah,
I look quite well. It's not until, like, the doctors operate and they go in my brain and they see it, like, not like they don't, they're not looking at scans, they're looking directly at my brain and they're like, oh, she is actually ill. Like,
yeah,
they physically have to see it.
So in terms of a lot of the time, advocating as a patient with a invisible illness is quite difficult. How have you found, would you say you're good at advocating for yourself? Is it something that the doctors still don't listen to?
Yeah, I actually really struggle because, like, the doctors, they have a really arrogant attitude. You know, their attitude is basically, I went to uni and I've been like studying like surgery or whatever for like longer than you, so I know more than you. So I feel like that's a very like bad attitude to have, because as I said, we're not all textbook. I've had a lot of complications that, like, my pediatric consultant, he admittedly said that, like, he has no idea why I had the complications that I've had throughout my life. But I feel like med students, they are sometimes a lot more understanding than the consultants, because obviously they're still at that learning stage. But yeah, it does really upset me, because, like, it's hard enough to have the chronic illness, but to have the doctor's ignorance, that just makes it worse. And then in terms of coping with it, I just talk to my family and friends.
Yeah, no, I found something I heard in, I don't know where I heard it, it could have been on Grey's Anatomy, right? But
I love Grey.
But, like, being a doctor is a lifelong learning thing. You constantly have to learn. And yeah, so the fact that doctors are like, oh, I went to university, I learned, and it's like, there's something else I heard, which is, don't confuse your potentially just one lecture on it with my lifelong experience.
That is so true.
Yeah, and I feel like the older generations, like, as you said, the med students, they're still in that process of active learning, so they're going to listen to patient experiences, whereas I've noticed the older doctors are the ones who are kind of more stuck in their ways of going, no.
Definitely.
Yeah, and it's all about, oh yeah, continue.
Sorry, I just want to say, like, it's kind of weird when, like, your entire sort of, like, profession is based around, like, treating people with, like, a variety of illnesses, and, like, there are, like, 8 billion people in existence, and obviously you can't know what's up with all of their bodies and how they react. So, like, saying that, like, I have gone to school, I have gone through this, I have years of experience, obviously you can have years of experience, but you can still come across something that you don't know a lot about, and there's nothing wrong in admitting that and just trying to understand more.
Yeah, it's like, I would genuinely prefer a doctor who goes, I don't know much about this, but I'm willing to learn, tell me, and I will do my research. That's so much better than a doctor who goes, you're not making sense, this is all fake.
Yeah, like my pediatric consultant, he, like, admittedly over the years has always said to my mum, like, I think there's something else wrong with her. I think there's something underlying, but I just can't figure it out. And, like, there was one point, I was really young, so obviously I don't remember this. This is just what my mum's told me. He had no idea how to treat me. So he took all of my scans and took them to one of his world neuro conferences. So obviously, like, he admittedly says that he has not got a clue why my brain and body is reacting the way it does, and, like, why it's not textbook, and, like, why I've had so many complications. And that's just what we want. We just want them, we don't, if you don't know the answer, we don't care. We just want you to admit it and not make us feel bad for it.
Yeah, doctors are humans, not robots. Like, you're not going to know everything, and that's fine, but don't make it the patient's fault. Yeah,
we just want you to try and figure out a treatment, but don't, like, be arrogant about it.
Yeah. So when you were talking about your pediatric consultant who was obviously chatting to your mum a lot, in your I'd say, teens and getting to the age of like 20 now, do you still have someone come into appointments with you? I found that's the only way I can get through to the doctors.
I still have my mum come to appointments because the thing with me is like at appointments, like the doctors, they don't always phrase their questions in ways that I can understand. And like sometimes like I'll forget what's being said. And like, so if I was to go to an appointment by myself and then I came outside and like my mum said, like, what did they say? How did the appointment go? I actually would not be able to tell her. I wouldn't remember what the
Same.
doctor said. So I still rely on having my mum there for appointments.
Yeah, no, I found literally the same thing. Like, the other thing I found with doctors is they'll also ask you a question, but then I don't know exactly what they're looking for in an answer. Like, they ask, what's your symptoms? And I'll go, well, these are my symptoms. And they've gone, well, you haven't got this symptom, so you obviously don't have it. And I'm like, well, I do have that symptom, but like, I didn't realize that's not normal.
Exactly, like, yeah, I completely get what you mean. Like, at appointments, so like, obviously, I talk for myself, but like, my mum's there to explain the question if I don't understand what the doctor's saying. Because, like,
Yeah.
I feel like doctors, they struggle to understand questions to patients in a very simplistic way. Whereas, like, your own mum, she knows how your brain works, she knows what you understand and what you don't understand.
Yeah. So have you found your mum to be one of those like lifeline sort of people in your life?
Definitely, she really advocates for me. So while I'm admitted into hospital, I actually, like, even when I was an adult, I had her stay with me because for the same reason about like I struggle at appointments, obviously ward rounds, that basically counts as an appointment.
Yeah.
So I had her there with that, and I did find that like the staff on the adults ward, they did not like that because obviously people in adults typically don't stay with their parents, but my
Yeah.
mum's my carer, so they couldn't come to terms with that because like it's I don't have obvious like learning difficulties or anything like that. So they were like my mum said that like she had to stay with me, and like they said, no, you're not allowed. And like there was like a whole like uproar about it. And then like I think it was like the ward manager, like one of those people, they were like, does she have learning difficulties? And it's like, well, what do I say to that? Like, what does it matter?
It shouldn't matter. It's like during lockdown, did you find that it was even more difficult? I found it was more difficult during lockdown.
Thankfully, I wasn't in hospital during lockdown.
That's good.
So I was actually quite lucky about that part because I don't know how it would have been during lockdown. So I was very lucky about that.
Yeah, because they did have that whole only one person can come into A&E and things, and I don't think anybody should have to eat. Like, we're 20, it doesn't mean we're an actual adult yet. Like, I still feel the
Exactly.
same age as when I was like 16 and like scared to go to appointments. I don't want to go alone.
Exactly, like especially going to A&E, like I literally could not focus on anything. I can't hold a conversation or anything when I'm in A&E.
Yeah, I've gone having gotten concussions from like falls and things, and it's like there is no way I can go and deal with that on my own. So someone has had to come
No,
with me.
you
And they're
shouldn't have to
like,
be like expected to either.
yeah. And they're like, no, you can't have anyone with you. And it's like, are you going to keep an eye on me then? Because
It
the
makes no sh
receptionist, yeah.
it makes no
Exactly.
sense. Like they like logically, if you think about it, they have other patients to look after, but they're also against like patients having like people like their friends and family over to look after them. Like
Yeah.
exactly.
It
So
doesn't make sense.
when my mum was at the hospital with me, my mum, like as much as they didn't want her to be staying at the hospital with me, my mum helped them massively. Like I couldn't shower on my own. I still can't shower on my own. So my mum was showering for me. I struggled to cut up my food sometimes, especially on my bad days. So she was cutting up my food for me. She would like brush my hair on the days that I couldn't, help me get dressed, like all sorts of things that if she wasn't there, the nurses would literally have to be like one to one with me. Like, yeah. It wouldn't work out. Like, there's so many things that my mum helped me with. Like, she basically, like, freed up a staff member.
That's, I was just thinking, when I was about 16, 17, I was volunteering in a hospital. I was on one of the wards as a volunteer. Yeah. So I did about 3 hours a week. And we're not allowed, well, the hospital I was at, you weren't allowed to do it for paediatrics, because obviously that's quite, there's a lot of vulnerable children. There's a lot of, you have to be very trained to do things like that. So we were in the adult wards. And thinking about it now, after what you've just said, we were one-to-one with a lot of them. And we were vital to the nurses to let them do their jobs. We were doing things like cleaning and just sitting with some of the patients. And we weren't allowed to physically do much contact things with them, like showering or anything. But that's what the HCAs, the healthcare assistants, did. Yeah. But just sitting one-to-one with the patients, if they don't allow people to come in, there's not enough volunteers to do that. And then the nurses can't focus on their jobs. So I think they should. Exactly. They really should allow.
You know, I actually, like, before I fell ill again, I did actually try to do some volunteering at my hospital, but unfortunately I was still, like, under my paediatric consultant at that time. It was, like, in the process where I was, like, transitioning, so my name was still under him, so they were like, you can't volunteer on this ward because you're technically still a patient on this ward. So it didn't work out, but I would have loved to do it. But, like, the HCAs and, like, the nurses, I do, like, really wish, like, there was more help with it. So also another thing that my mum helped me with was, so, like, with the orthostatic hypotension, the physios, they said that I needed to use my Zimmer frame and, like, do, like, a squat walk. And so basically I had an intracranial pressure monitor, which I guess we'll talk about later. So with that, my mum couldn't hold my monitor and then be there with me, because I needed, like, while I had the monitor in, I needed two people walking with me because of the monitor. And then if I was to collapse, so then someone would be there to catch me. But then, like, I would try to get in, like, at least, like, a couple walks a day. Like, I was trying to do, like, I was trying to put the work in, but then they, like, no one would want to go on the walks with me. Like, they would basically, like, put me down to the bottom of the pile.
I guess that means that while they were trying to make things accessible, they did a really bad job of it, because it wasn't accessible for two people to,
Definitely, that's quite hard. I did really feel, like, very neglected during my most recent adult submission.
Yeah, so I guess we are talking about it, about your experience with doctors now. And have you found that your doctors are maybe more helpful, understanding, aware, or is it worse than?
Yeah, so no, though, since moving to adult. So since moving to adults, it has been awful. I literally don't trust them, and I'm now scared of meeting new doctors because of my current adult team. I've actually lost a lot of respect for them, and I really feel like they've just pushed me to the side. In regards to my orthostatic hypotension, I am seeing cardiology, but I had to ask for a referral of my own back, because while I was in the hospital under the neuro ward, I had a 48-hour ECG, which showed multiple episodes of tachycardia, and I also documented that I felt very short of breath just walking short distances, which is why they were going to refer me to cardiology. Yeah. But instead of referring me to cardiology, they referred me to gynecology for an operation, and I don't need to see gynecology. And when I questioned that, no one owned up about why I'd been referred to gynecology. And no one switched the gynecology referral to cardiology. They just completely refused.
Wait, they referred you for gynecology for a surgery?
Mm-hmm. And the ablation.
Do you know why?
Literally not got a clue. Thing is, though, so many people were like, maybe it's because they saw the college at the end. But so many, like, specialties have college at the end.
Yeah.
Like oncology, cardiology, ophthalmology, neurology, like, there's so many ologies.
I guess I'm trying to think, maybe gynecology and cardiology sound the same, but I don't think they do.
They don't sound the same.
And the fact that they referred me for a literal procedure to have an ablation, like, I think that's so high risk. Like, I saw the letter and I was like, gynecology, I don't need to see a gynecologist, thankfully.
Was it, is it possible that it was like switched accidentally, like he got another patient's referral instead of like your own, and that patient probably got referred yours?
It could be, because like I literally referred, like I phoned the number on the letter and I was like, what's this about? And then she was like, oh, we're coming, like you've got an appointment to discuss having an ablation. And I was like, I don't need an ablation, I can definitely tell you that, like please cancel this.
That is so that's really bad. Like I try not to like be so negative, but that is a really
it's
an actual procedure. It's not even like consultation, it's a full procedure that they referred to you for, which is why would you do that?
Like luckily I had my mum, but like if it's someone that like is on their own and they can't think straight, what if they went to that like and like consented to have the ablation not knowing what they were consenting to have?
Yeah.
That's actually like so dangerous.
That's a and, that's like, a safeguarding issue.
Massively. And like no one has admitted to referring me. I haven't got a clue who referred me.
How,
and the fact that they didn't like fix the issue and switch the referral.
How long ago was this, like a recent thing or years ago?
Very recent. It was last year.
Right. And you still haven't got, have you tried to escalate it and like speak to some top up people?
What, and like the gynecology referral?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so at the moment. We're just trying to focus on getting everything else sorted, and then we'll probably go back to that once everything else is sorted.
That's fair enough, yeah.
But in terms of cardiology, so obviously I got to see them off my own back, and they have actually been amazing so far. They gave me like an appointment, actually I think quite quick for their NHS, like it wasn't like ASAP, but it was in like 2 or 3 months, which I think is really good.
Yeah, that is.
And the nurse who like was at my appointment, she thoroughly listened to me, and like, you know when they give you like the review of the appointment, like when you like leave the appointment and you get the letter a few weeks after. I was reading the letter and like me and my mum were like, oh my god, like this letter literally like shows that she's listened to us, like it, she's full-on listened, it says exactly what I said, like there's no like misleading things on air.
Do you know what's bad is the fact that we're also amazed by the fact that they listen. We shouldn't be amazed.
It's literally, they're like, they did their job and we're shocked that they actually did their job properly.
The standards of care that we expect of them is so low that we're like, oh my gosh, they listen to me.
It's so true.
It's like Dante's ninth circle of hell. That's where the bar is.
Literally. Yeah.
Because like she also acknowledged that like my mum's my carer, and like I don't think many doctors acknowledge that, that my mum's a carer for me.
That's so your mum is a care, as in like with the documents and everything, she's done all the documentation for that?
No, so she's not like officially put down as my carer, but she is my carer, if that makes sense. Like it's not like she's, it's not like official in writing, I don't think, but she does care for me.
Is there a reason it's not official in writing? I'm leading towards something here, but
I think it could be something to do with her wages, I think.
Right, because I was thinking, oh, just continue.
Because she works alongside looking after me, so as like ever since I've known, like she, like even though we've been at the hospital, she's still been sat at her laptop working, like, you know, she rarely, like the only times that she takes off is like if I have to be like at an in-person appointment or if I'm going to surgery, but like all throughout my time being in hospital and like if I'm ill at home, she'll be working whilst looking after me at the same time as working.
That's got to be difficult, like to balance everything. But she sounds like such a good, she sounds like such a good mum and such a good person.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. Ray, did you have something you wanted to add? You looked like you did, but I don't know.
No, I don't particularly have anything.
Okay, that's fair enough. Well, the next sort of question was about misconceptions and stigmas, and we have kind of touched on those, but I was wondering if you wanted to take a moment to just talk about the stigmas and misconceptions and kind of say, have your piece on it and go, well, this isn't true and I want you to know why.
Yeah, so basically over the years, so obviously I think I said at the beginning that it was originally put down to childhood bugs and viruses.
Yeah.
And then as I've gotten older, it's been stuff like it's your period that's causing this, it's exam stress, it's general female hormones, it's because you've just started secondary school, oh, you must be bored, which is actually a very recent one that I got told, oh, you're just bored.
You're bored, so you have a chronic illness?
Yeah, like my fatigue was so bad that they were like, you must be bored, because I actually, do you know what? I saw a doctor and he was like, do you like gaming? Like, not like Animal Crossing sort of gaming, but you know, like your typical sort of gaming. And I was like, I actually, I'm not into gaming. And I, and then he was like, oh, you must be bored. I was like, there's plenty of other things for me to do. And like, being bored doesn't cause a chronic illness.
Yeah, it has no, it, there's literally no link between the two.
Literally.
And I am surprised they talked about like gaming. Like, what does gaming have to do with this?
I have no idea. Do you know what? I don't know if we had the Switch in the hospital, because like my mum also plays on the Switch as well. So I don't know if he just like looked at the Switch and saw the Switch and thought, does she like game like a typical gamer? But like, I literally have no idea what the link is.
I'm a bit speechless.
Yeah. I don't know what to say either.
No, I was literally gobsmacked. I was like, no, I don't game, and no, I'm not bored, I'm just feeling very ill and tired right now, and I'm going to speak out.
That is so bad. And they, I don't understand, like, doctors have modules in university to go through what is acceptable to say to patients, and there's just some things that you hear, and it's like, Did the common sense go out of the window?
You're gaming, you're bored, and therefore you have a chronic illness.
There was actually another thing that I forgot to mention in the last question.
Oh, yeah.
So while I was in AMU, this was before I got diagnosed with orthostatic hypertension. I was in the AMU, and the AMU doctor, he actually said to me, I want to see you faint, because it will be a good source of entertainment for me. I could really use that entertainment today. I was like,
that is awful.
I don't think you can say that. Like, that is just not acceptable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You,
when he said that,
could
I was
file
like,
a complaint.
I don't want to see him again. I literally said to the nurses, I was like, I refuse to talk to him if he's going to laugh at me.
That is awful. You are in hospital, vulnerable, and the doctor's just like, let me just stare at you for a bit and watch you go through something that is awful.
Mm-hmm. Literally, he literally just said to me, you just need to smile and be happy and then you won't faint. You fainting is going to be a good source of entertainment for me. I was like, that is not how it works.
To be fair, this time last year, I think it was March, I was admitted to hospital because I had a particularly long seizure. The doctor afterwards was talking to me and was like, do you know what you need to do? Is you need to wake up at 5 or 6 in the morning every day and go for like a 5 kilometer run. And I was thinking, that's really not what I need to work.
I feel like that would just make you worse.
Literally, because like, not, this isn't about, so I don't know whether we'll cut this out or not, but my seizures, they're not epileptic. There's not a known cause for them. So he was like, you know, go for a run, you know, get, and I'm like, that's not, like, even if you don't know the cause, going for a run is not going to stop the seizures.
No. It's not going to help.
It's very different from this, but like, it reminds me, like, when I, like, when I was like 17, I told, like, I think I told my, like, I told my aunt that I had been diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and she was like, oh, it's all just in your head, you just need to get out a bit. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think it's in my intestines, that's not where depression happens. But
exactly, you can't help it, like there's nothing that you can do to help, like
you just need to get out more so that you're not depressed. I'm like, thanks, I haven't tried that in years.
It's not that simple for anyone.
Yeah. That's honestly, the fact that he said that to you, though, in the first place, it's like...
literally gobsmacked.
Yeah. I genuinely think you could have, like, filed a complaint.
Did you file a complaint?
We're definitely going to look into it. Like, honestly, like, we did start, like, the whole PALS process. I'm not going to lie, I don't know entirely where we are with that, because with everything going on, as I said, we're now focusing on getting like my health sorted first. But like, that was like that AMU doctor, that situation happened at Reading, and then I've got all of the stuff that happened at John Radcliffe. So it's two different PALS teams, so it's like there's a lot of confusion with it.
Yeah,
that's, and like, so it's bad. A lot to deal with aside from just like getting your diagnoses and like getting your treatment, like having like so many things, other things to deal with aside from your treatment. Like, you don't need that additional sort of stress on top of your treatment and just exactly. Your condition in general.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm still like processing what he said to you. It's still like,
you know, I was literally in shock. Do you know what, the amount of times I cried during that admission was literally awful, because also while I was in Reading, the rooms in Reading is absolutely tiny, so thankfully Reading is so close to where I live, so my mum would leave me at night and then she would get to the hospital like at like, god, it must have been like 6 or something, it was before ward rounds. And then she would be there all day working, and then she'd go home in the evenings. And I can't remember where I was leading with this, actually, sorry. But I really struggled with that. But luckily, Oxford, the rooms are a lot bigger. Although they didn't like her staying with me, the rooms are bigger, so she can stay. And I live about like an hour with no traffic from Oxford, yeah. So... she would have not been able to see me at Oxford if she was sleeping at home.
So when were you referred to Oxford originally? Was that when you were 4 with the diagnosis, or?
Yeah, so my original referral to Oxford was when I was 4.
And you got the diagnosis at Oxford. I'm assuming there's no neuro at Reading. You can't get a diagnosis there.
Yeah, so I am, my local A&E that I have now, that hasn't always been my local A&E. It was Wexham, because I used to live in Sippenham. So I, the diagnosis, it started at Wexham. I guess they must have said, we think you have IOH, but we need to refer you to a specialist to confirm. And then I got referred to John Radcliffe, and then that's where they confirmed that I have IOH.
Okay, yeah, that makes more sense. Okay, so the next sort of question, again, I feel like we have spoken about, but just, can you just shed some light on your experiences with the types of treatments you've been having over the past, what is it now, 16 years, and how's it been?
Yeah, it's been very complicated. So obviously, they don't want to do surgery first off, obviously. So they tried many different types of medication and different doses of the medication. None of that worked. So from the age of 5, I've had multiple shunts. There are a few different types of shunt, but one shunt that's most commonly placed. And it actually took a very long time for them to find a shunt that my body would respond well to.
Okay. So are we under the impression that's shunts then? It's a very specific and tailored to the person, it's not a one size fits all thing with shunts.
I don't know, because like every doctor has like, well, not every doctor, that like my consultants and like, well, all doctors that I've come across, and like my pediatric consultant and like my adult consultant, they have no idea why I've not reacted so well to my shunts, because the most common shunt is to go into your abdomen, because a shunt drains your cerebral spinal fluid, and obviously your abdomen is the biggest cavity for it to drain into, so it would be the best option for most people, but it's a bit more complicated for me.
That's fair enough, yeah.
It took a long time for them to find one that would work.
Do you think it was more complicated for you because you're not a textbook patient with the textbook course?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, fair enough.
The question that I had earlier is about, when you mentioned that you're not a textbook patient, and on the NHS website it says weight loss as a suggested treatment for IAH. So the question was basically is the suggestion misguided in a way? Because obviously you also, there will be a lot of people who do not fit the textbook stereotype of patients with IAH, and is it in terms of does it make things a lot more difficult to get proper diagnosis and treatments?
Yeah, I do feel like it's very misguided. I can't talk for everyone, obviously, but I do feel like it's really misguided, because obviously myself, I'm an example. They believe I was born with it, and some people may be overweight and have IAH, but not everyone. It's not the cause. It just says that in the statistics.
Yeah, okay. I find it so weird that a lot of the things that doctors say is lose weight. It's for PCOS as well. It's yes, these things are related to it, but that doesn't mean that your first port of call should just be to say lose weight and not investigate anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Luckily, I don't think that assumption was put onto me, but I do know it is put onto a lot of people with IIH.
Are you in group chats or anything with other people with IIH? Or do you know of them who have said that's happened?
No, I don't. I actually have only met one person that's my age with IIH. Otherwise, I actually don't really know anyone with IIH.
That's really interesting, because one of the first things I did was find a group chat and a support group. I guess the difference was is I randomly became part of that community at a random age, whereas you were brought up from the age of 4 having known what it was. But was there a reason you didn't go looking for support groups, or?
Not really, just general, I haven't been able to find any support groups, no specific reason. I've just not been able to find any support groups.
That's fair enough. However, you have got a TikTok account, and that has given people, not just you, me as well, a community of people to kind of talk to and just feel not alone with. And something that you've spoken about on your TikTok account is that you've had surgeries, and we've spoken about it before that you had roughly 30, I think you said. So are you able to just talk a bit about more about what the surgeries have done and how it helps?
Yeah, so I've had a number of surgeries, so ranging from an intracranial pressure monitor, which is quite a quick surgery. They literally just put a wire into your brain. I don't think it goes that deep into the brain, and it measures your intracranial pressure within the brain. And then more invasive surgeries, where I've had a number of different shunts which have drained into my heart or my stomach or my lungs. A shunt can go into the brain or the base of the spine. I originally had all of mine placed at the base of my spine, because having it placed into my brain was too risky due to how small my ventricles are. They are literally almost non-existent. But the shunts in my spine kept on failing, so they had no choice but to attempt to put the shunts into my brain. I also had a cranial expansion when I was quite young, which is where they basically took my skull apart to make my head bigger, in hopes to give my brain more space. so that the fluid wouldn't put pressure on my brain. But unfortunately, my brain still had pressure on it after the cranial expansion.
Fair enough. And there's some other things that having researched can be done in terms of treatment, things with your optic nerve and things like that. Is that something you've had to have done or not something?
I mean, the shunts, for me personally, usually fix the issues with the
Fair
optic.
enough. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then the final one, which I'm really interested to know your opinion on, is the fact that IIH has another name, pseudotumor cerebri. What is your opinion on this name? And yeah, basically, what's your opinion? What have you got to say on that?
Yeah, I think it's extremely damaging because obviously pseudo means false,
Yeah.
and no illness should be seen as false because every illness is real, and I don't think any illness or any person's symptoms should be compared to another. So it is very harmful.
Yeah, have you found doctors have said that, or you've got that written on records, or have you not had that attached to you?
Luckily, I haven't, but I do know that it has been called that. But luckily, I haven't been told that it's pseudo tumor cerebri. It's always been called IIH to me.
And is that I'm sure you might not know the answer to this. Was it originally pseudotumor cerebri and then they changed the name because they realized how harmful it was, or
I'm not entirely sure actually, because obviously, it's still in the when you look it up online, it's still very much online. Like it's always been online as pseudotumor cerebri, but I actually don't know. I'm assuming that when I was diagnosed, I'm pretty sure they probably said IIH. I don't think they've ever used pseudotumor in front of
yeah.
in regards to me. But
But
whether
yeah.
doctors do now to other people, I don't know, but in my personal experience, they've never called it that to me.
Yeah, I've had pseudo seizures and things like that, which just assumes it's the whole assuming that it's fake and that there's not something real going on. It's
I
like,
think it's so harmful just hearing the word fake.
yeah. It's damaging. It's like we're attention seeking, or there's something going on that if they don't know, they don't know. If the cause hasn't been found yet, that's fair enough. Advancing technology will hopefully bring something to light, but they don't have to just say it's fake just because they don't understand it.
Exactly, like saying it's fake is like saying that you're shaking your body around intentionally when in reality you can't help it. It's like uncontrollable, like
Yeah.
you're not putting it on, but then saying pseudo implies that.
Yeah, no, it really does. I think that's been one of the weirdest things about the medical field that I came across when I was researching things. I'm like, why are we labeling things as being fake?
Yeah,
It's so bad.
it's very common, like if they don't understand something, but they see like it's similar to something else, they're just like, oh, it's like this, but like not really this, so like let's just call it pseudo. But then like the word pseudo, it just means false,
Yeah.
and
Exactly. I
that
feel like
sort of like feeds into more harmful narrative that the condition in itself is non-existent.
I feel like they think we're stupid, like as if we're not going to look up what pseudo means.
Yeah.
Like we're obviously going to look up what that means.
Yeah, it's people go to these appointments, and then especially I've only seen pseudo something be associated with like a long-term thing. So patients are gonna have it for a while, so they're gonna do their research on it. And it's like I know in DSM-5, which is the like diagnostic thing, I think pseudo for what I've got is now kind of being taken out. Like, but a load of things, like I checked my medical records the other day and I saw pseudo something and I was like,
Take that out,
that's
please.
not,
I think
yeah.
it also like kind of stretches on, like if you think about like back in the day, this was like way more common, and like people often didn't have the means to like look up things as easily as we do right now. And like they just haven't changed things, which is like something that's very common in the medical field. Like it's change is very slow, which is it
massively.
Shouldn't really be, because every day you have like new research, you have different cases, and like each one's different from the others. Like just having sort of like referring things that are like really old, like 40 years old and stuff like that, to understand cases that are like happening today and using those same terms is kind of regressive.
Well, this might be a controversial kind of take, but I also think more and more people are starting to think it, which is that mainly these pseudo sort of conditions are being labeled on predominantly female cases. And it's like, like hysteria, for example, back in, if that was now, people would look online and be like, that is not okay. But back, as you were saying, Ray, back in the day when there wasn't easy access to research things in libraries and internet, it's like they would have just taken it at face value, whereas nowadays we are online and we are going to look it up, and we have a better ability to talk back to the doctors and the healthcare professionals who are labeling it these things and go, that's not right, you shouldn't be calling it that.
Yeah, it's just sort of like with making sort of like more information more accessible, and like it's gotten more accessible, but at the same time, like a lot of like really important literature is still like very inaccessible in the way that it's written and the way that like you can access it. And but yeah, things have like definitely changed and people are more aware, and it's easier to look things up. So they're just like, okay, we're going to like name it pseudo similar to this condition so that they don't really think about it a lot. But then that's kind of like,
Oh, Ray, I think you froze. Do you mind repeating the last little bit that you said?
No, I was just saying like, it was similar to like what I said before, like the idea like that we have more access to resources and stuff like that, so like they can't really just say like, oh, you have this, you can go home, you need to believe me, there's nothing else you can do about it. But then they still have to like give it a name, so they just give it like pseudo similar to said condition. But then it's again kind of stupid to do that, because you obviously know